This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we rebroadcast two of the best interviews we've done in our last 18 years on this program. The first is with Mel Wolfe, the great constitutional litigator and head of litigation for the ACLU. And the second is his friend and colleague, Bill Schaap. They worked together in exposing the CIA.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith. Attorney Mel Wolfe died at age 95 on July 1, 2023. He was one of the greatest constitutional litigators of his time. He served as legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union for 15 years. Today, we bring you a rebroadcast of an interview that attorney Michael Ratner and I, Michael Smith, did with Mel 10 years ago for a segment we called Lawyers You'll Like. It's a scintillating, fast-paced discussion with a relevance to our situation now. Give a listen.
For this segment of Lawyers You'll Like, we're pleased to be joined by attorney Mel Wolfe, former legal director of the ACLU. In his long career, Mel represented some of the most important civil rights movements and groups in the United States. Today we'll talk to him about the AG case, where he tried to get Phil Agee's passport back, his work in the Deep South in the 60s, representing Mississippi Summer in 1964, and numerous other cases he argued before the Supreme Court. He has remarkable opinions on the court today and the court of yesterday, as well as what's happened to civil liberties in the United States. Mel Wolfe, welcome to Law and Disorder.
You bet.
Mel, throughout my career, I'm a little younger than you, you've been one of the, quote, lawyers I like, and I want our listeners to say you're one of the lawyers they like. So here we are for a segment on Mel Wolfe and lawyers you'll like. Now, you've been had a long history, 15 years, I think, as legal director of the ACLU.
At least.
At least. It's felt like more, I know, Mel. But the case I want to start with, and then we'll go back to some of your remarkable history, is the Phil Agee case. Phil Agee was, of course, a former CIA agent who wrote a book called Inside the Company, revealed a couple hundred names of CIA people.
All over South and Central America.
All over. So, and the reason I want to bring it up first is because recently I got a request saying, Michael, you know, the U.S. took away the passport from Ed Snowden. So he's sitting in Moscow without a U.S. passport. And they said, can't we bring a lawsuit to get Ed Snowden's passport back? And I just typed them four letters, AG. So why don't you tell us about why Ed Snowden would have a very tough time getting his passport back?
Well, he would, because Phil Agee, as you said, was a dissident CIA agent who spent decades working against the CIA, published a couple of books, a political memoir, Inside the Company, which you referred to. But he lost his passport because when the dissidents took over the American embassy in Tehran in
79,
the New York Post carried a story accusing Phil of helping the students who had invaded the embassy to put together the all that written material that had been shredded.
How could he do that?
Well, he didn't do it. It was a total, you know, another New York Post lie, bald-faced lie. And in any case, the State Department, based upon that story, revoked his passport. He was then living in, I think he was then living in Hamburg, actually, as he had been for a while. Anyhow, they revoked his passport, and we started, I had been representing AG for a long time. I was his principal lawyer for 30 years and had received a total of $1,500 in fees from my 30 years representation.
Blood money, Mel.
From an
that's 50 cents a year.
And that was from the government. The government paid me for an FOIA case that I did for Phil. In any case, they revoked his passport on national security grounds. And we started a lawsuit, and we went to the district court in the District of Columbia. We won it there based upon a U.S. Supreme Court decision some years earlier on behalf of Kent. What was Kent's
first? Rockwell Kent.
Rockwell Kent.
Famous U.S. artist.
Yeah,
famous
Leonard Boudin
US
was left
his,
wing,
was his
left-wing,
attorney.
Left-wing artist. And they had taken his passport away for political reasons. And the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional that they couldn't revoke his passport for the reasons for the national security reasons given. So we were thought we were in the catbird seat and started an action for Phil. We won it in the district court, and the government appealed, and we won it again in the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. And then finally, the government appealed, went to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court, they couldn't get Agee, so they got his lawyer instead, and they really gave me a really, really hard time in that argument.
Really?
And they reversed them. They reversed Kent. They said Kent doesn't apply in this case, and they didn't say exactly why, because it did apply, obviously. But they voted 6-3. Agee was very widely disliked in Washington because he was well known to be a CIA dissident who had disclosed the names of lots and lots of CIA agents. And he wasn't much liked in the Washington community. Anyhow, they stood the Kent decision on its head, and by a vote of 6-3, upheld the State Department's withdrawal of cancellation of Phil's passport. And I dare say, if Snowden went the same route today, he would do even worse in this Supreme Court than I did, which was a 6-3 vote. And that's why Snowden won't get his passport back. Thanks to me.
We're talking to attorney Mel Wolf, a lawyer you'll like. And Mel, it strikes me and Michael that you're rare in a lot of respects, particularly this one, that unlike Michael and me, you're a 50s radical. We would call ourselves 60s radical, but you got like a half a generation on us. And
more than that, I think.
Not much more. And
I'm going to be 86 next week.
Congratulations.
I wanted to get that in.
The generation 20 years or 30 years, Mel?
Don't know.
Well, any case, how did a guy get your great sensibilities coming up in the 50s out of Troy, New York?
Well, it's you're asking me for deep psychoanalytic insights, which I don't have.
You could be superficial.
And I don't no doubt I will be. Actually, my family were owners of a business in Troy, and I worked they made men's clothing. And I worked in the factory often, and I got to know the guys who worked on the floor and the cutting room and the women who worked on the sewing machines. And somehow or other, I don't know why, I sort of preferred the guys who were working on the floor rather than my father and his brothers who were working in the front office. I was for the worker and not for the bosses. And I've always been for the workers and not for the bosses, which I think is the distinguishing political factor in our world today. Which side are you on? That was the basic background for the development, I think, of my left liberal, quasi-radical attitudes towards American political life.
How come you decided to go to law school?
I did it to avoid being drafted during the Korean War. Actually.
Oh, same with me.
Korean War?
We're talking Vietnam. Oh. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like same war.
Yeah. I got
every year there's a draft. So, I mean, there was.
Every year there's a war.
Right, that's
I got my bachelor's degree in 1952, and I had a Navy commission, which I had gotten from the New York State Maritime Academy some years earlier on. But the Maritime Academy didn't count as military service because the Merchant Marine did not. And my draft board sent me a 1A notice, so I applied to law school. Went to Columbia. And when I finished Columbia, they sent me another 1A notice because the draft was still on. So I activated my commission. I spent 2 years in the Navy as a lieutenant junior grade officer in Southern California, wow. Actually.
I didn't know that. Well, let's bring you from Southern California to Southern America, because that's early 60s. There's the height of the Civil Rights Movement. You were
deeply
involved.
The beginning of the heights of the Civil Rights Movement. And I was at that time, I went to work at the ACLU in 1958 as assistant legal director. In 1962, I was given the job of the legal director of the ACLU. And the summer of 64, I had actually been going down to Mississippi from 1961 to 62, working with then one of the two black lawyers who were practicing in Mississippi, a wonderful guy named R.J.S. Brown, who worked out of Jackson. And he and I, he called the ACLU out of the blue once, and I responded. And he had a case, a capital case, and he wanted some help. And I went down to Jackson, tried that case with him, and I was barely. To call me a trial lawyer was a vast overstatement. But in any case, we went ahead and Jess and I tried a couple of capital cases together in around Mississippi, in Jackson and Philadelphia and in Vicksburg, I remember. And I continually argued the question of systematic exclusion of blacks from the jury. And I finally got a case up to the Mississippi Supreme Court on that issue. And I argued, I said, if you don't do it, the federal courts will. And they said, sit down, Mr. Wolf. We've heard enough from you. But the fact of the matter is that for 12 or 15 years, because of the work that Jess and I did on the exclusion issue, and actually the Supreme Court of Mississippi threw out the conviction that I had argued and asked them to, and they had asked me to sit down. For 12 or 15 years, there was not an execution in Mississippi of any African American, because of they conceded that the exclusion tainted every conviction, and they weren't going to change it. So instead of giving these black guys a death penalty, they just sentenced them to life without parole. But it was a step in the right direction.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a famous incident that happened at Columbia. I went to Columbia as well, but we had James Meredith in the class, who was the first black man to desegregate University of
Mississippi.
So there was a case that came up, and a black guy who had accused of raping a white woman in Mississippi or something, had only gotten life imprisonment. The professor says to the class, why do you think that black man only got life in prison? And Meredith raises his hand and says, because he was innocent. So it's a great anecdotal Columbia story. In any case,
then summer of 64 was coming upon us. You all remember,
sure.
Summer 64 voter registration project. We had heard that the Guild was starting a program to see if they could find some lawyers around the country who would go down and help out during the summer, the Mississippi summer. And we at the ACLU thought that was a terrific idea and that we would do it also. And we weren't going to do it in conjunction with the Guild, because the ACLU and the Guild were sort of get on very well.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, the Guild was looked at by many people, including some of your colleagues at the ACLU, as a communist front.
Yeah.
And they were worried that the Guild was getting a foothold, because the Communist Party had been active in desegregation for many years in the South.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And so they looked at the Guild as that. And then I remember, because I was a part of the Guild.
Well, the ACLU had a terrible history of anti-communism.
I forgot that,
right. they threw
Helen Gurley Flynn.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn.
Off the board. Helen Gurley Flynn is different.
Off the board. She's because she was CP,
right.
And they had a long, despicable position on CPers within the ACLU. Anyhow, that was, you know, and the Guild looked at the ACLU as sort of a bunch of bourgeois liberals, which we were. although I must say that I was invited to speak, to give the main speech at a Guild annual meeting in Washington. When was it? In the 70s, I think. And Joe Rao, you remember Joe
sure,
Rao?
I knew sure. Joe. I used to Joe? Work with Joe.
Did you work with Joe?
Sure.
Joe got in touch with the executive director and wanted to have me fired because I spoke to the Guild.
Wow.
Actually. I mean, Joe Rao, now dead, was not a real civil libertarian. He never represented a member of the CP during all of his years.
Right.
before UAC and those. He represented only people who were not members of the CP.
I want to say something in defense of the Guild, Michael and Mel. The original idea for the Guild to go down south in 64 was the idea of Ernie Goodman, who was not a member of the Communist Party, and on various issues stood up against the Communist Party inside of the Guild. Mm-hmm. And it was Ernie that organized that. And in fact, the national office of the Lawyers Guild moved from New York, which was more oriented towards the CP, to Detroit, where Ernie had a major law firm.
Picking up on the fact that the Guild was starting this summer project, we started the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee and did to duplicate what they were doing. And I think we ended up enlisting a lot more lawyers than the Guild actually did. We had several hundred lawyers who went down to Mississippi for summer for periods of a week or two, sometimes longer.
What did the committee do, or what did the Guild committee, what was their work? I mean, they weren't doing death penalty
cases.
Well,
everybody, no, they were just representing people arrested in Mississippi during Mississippi summer. And they were, none of them were members of the Mississippi Bar, obviously. But most of the courts, and particularly the federal courts, particularly in the Northern District, the guy in the Southern District was a real fascist guy.
Who was Cox? Was that in the Southern District?
Cox was the Southern District, yeah. That's right. Yeah. No, he was a terrible guy.
He was the bad guy.
Anyhow, most of the judges allowed these out-of-state lawyers to come and make some sort of presentation. But it wasn't so much their role as lawyers that was important for those lawyers. It was their seeing what Mississippi was like back in 1964, you know, when it was like the Third Reich.
It still has some problems.
It was said some years ago that Mississippi, in fact, had more elected black officials than any other state in the Union, actually.
Yeah, well, there's
so
a
you
got
to give them credit for something.
Well,
anyhow, that was Mississippi summer.
And, well, Mel, proceeding along, I know you've argued 10 cases before the United States Supreme Court.
I did.
And I wanted to ask you
first your win and loss record, which is the main thing we're worried
about. I can't remember.
Well,
half and half.
When Bill Kuzler was asked that question, he said, better than Willie Mays, half and half isn't bad, given the kind of cases that you would take, Mel. Let's talk about some of those cases and some of the judges that you got entangled with.
Well, one was the SDS case, I think you mentioned to me earlier.
I, in fact, argued one, the only case argued in the Supreme Court of the United States on behalf of SDS.
SDS, the Students for Democratic Society.
Students for Democratic, which was the left-wing student group back in those days. And it was the case was called, I have it written down here in my Healy versus James. James was the president of a branch of the Connecticut State College system, and they had refused to allow a local group to organize on campus as an SDS, as an SDS membership organization. I won the case. And it was a good First Amendment decision, actually. I think it was unanimous, if I'm not mistaken. In any case, that was one of the cases I argued there. Another one, as we already discussed, was Phil Agee's passport case. Another Vietnam-related case that I argued and won was called Osterreich versus Selective Service. And Osterreich was a... He was in a public protest against the war, and Louis Hershey, who was head of the Selective Services system for a long time, personally ordered him to lose his draft board to change his status from exempt student to 1A. And somehow or other, he got to the ACLU. I took the case, and I litigated. It was out in Wyoming, actually. And I litigated it up to the Supreme Court and won that case also. You notice I'm only talking about the cases that I won and not the ones that I lost. That was a good decision also. Another case I argued, which was of some interest in involving abortion rights, in which I had I played a bit of a role in the early days of that issue, was called Bigelow versus Virginia. A newspaper in Virginia carried an advertisement about the availability of abortion services in New York, and the publisher or editor was indicted for violating a Virginia law prohibiting abortion there. And they got to the ACLU, and I took on that case and took it to the Supreme Court and won that case, actually, and got a reversal. And they held the newspaper had a First Amendment right to run advertisements about the availability of abortion out of state. Those were a couple of the cases that I litigated in the Supreme Court of the United States. But
before we go to the next case, I just want to give
I'm not going to the next case.
The next, what I want to mention again is Healy versus James, which is where you got the right of SDS to organize a chapter. What it says in the case,
Central Connecticut State College.
Right, but I think you and our listeners will get some kick out of the opening paragraph, which basically says, "We mentioned briefly at the outset the setting in 69 and 1970. A climate of unrest prevailed on many college campuses. Widespread civil disobedience, accompanied by seizure of buildings, vandalism, and arson. Some colleges had been shut down altogether, while at others files were looted and manuscripts destroyed. SDS chapters on some of these campuses had been a catalytic force during this period." You were representing a catalytic force, Mel.
At least.
Sounds like a car engine. But anyway, that gives you a sense of the times and where you were going in front of the court, which would have been in some way hostile to SDS, I would assume.
Well, I remember that I had a pretty good reception in that case, as a matter of fact. Vastly different than the reception I had arguing Phil Agee's passport case, as a
matter of fact. Mel, so you took some bruises by some of these judges, and I wanted to ask you, the various judges on the Supreme Court that you had to deal with, which ones did you admire the most?
Oh, well, our favorite Catholic, Thurgood Marshall, Brennan, those were, and in his day, the former KKK or Black
yeah.
Douglas. I mean, those were the, and Warren, of course, and you know, that was the core of the liberal Supreme Court in its day, from late 50s to the middle 60s or something along
what's
that
sad
line.
Is a lot of us until grew up
Berger,
with that court.
Until Berger took over. What'd you
say? We grew up with that court, so we had great expectations of going forward as law students and lawyers that we were going to have a great court.
No.
And then it took a dive. Well, most of your cases were argued during that period?
I argued the first one in 63 and the last one in 82.
Oh.
So it spanned that. It spanned that era. But those were the days, even with that very good court, they're not as helpful in communist Smith Act cases as they were for Black-related cases. And we our mantra was, if you're red, you lose. If you're Black, you win.
Okay.
That was true even of the Warren Court, actually.
Well, the judge I worked for, Constance Baker Motley, argued 10 cases like you in front of the Supreme Court, all having
she
to do.
She won them all, probably.
9 out of 10. So it just tells you how, at least at that point, the court was going to give its imprimatur to civil rights, Black civil rights.
Yeah, they were very good on that issue. But I think they still upheld the membership provision of the No, they eventually threw out the membership provision of the Subversive Activities Control Act, actually.
Well, now, Mel, you know, the Supreme Court and lower federal courts as well have gotten to be so bad, that there's discussion, Michael and I can report from the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, that people are talking about, well, what can we do and not have to go to court? So what's your take on why things got to be the way they are?
Oh, perfectly clear. The presidents who appointed these right-wing guys wanted a different court, wanted to go to the other end of the spectrum, the Warren Court. And I would like to take this opportunity, since I'm on the air and speaking publicly, to say that I think that, what's his name? Who's the worst judge on the Supreme Court?
Scalia.
Scalia is the worst judge in the history of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's a pointy-headed right-wing. He's the worst guy, and Thomas is the second worst Supreme Court justice in the history of the world.
I would think that Scalia
is a disgrace.
A disgrace to the business.
I don't know why Ruth Ginsburg is so friendly with him. They both like the opera, but if I were her, I'd stay away.
You know, if you go to arguments there, and you see it's terrible because I go to those cases. And half the argument is, Scalia doing intellectual bullshit, or BS, rather, for this radio station, with the lawyers who are arguing. It doesn't mean anything. He's just terrible. He takes all the time and just talks and talks.
Scalia, in my opinion, is very comfortable in that specter of opinion we could call Catholic fascism, right out of Franco. And I just read an interview with him in a magazine where he told the interview that he believes in the devil. And he also has said that he believes that God supports the death penalty. So, and this guy is like one of the main judges.
No, he's a lunatic. He's another right-wing lunatic with which the country is presently infested for some reason or other. If anyone can explain that to me, I'd appreciate it.
Any writings you want to point people to? Anything? I know you've not been a very prolific writer, but somewhat.
Well, my favorite piece is an article I published in The Nation some years ago, which was, in fact, there was a case called Poe versus Ullman, which was an early Supreme Court case involving the use of the availability of contraceptives in Connecticut. And I wrote an amicus brief for the ACLU in that case, Poe v. Ullman, which Justice Harlan, and I based it on the right to privacy, the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. Harlan picked it up in his concurring opinion in Poe v. Ullman, which ultimately got picked up by the Supreme Court and became the basis for the Roe versus Wade. And I described my thought process and my creative process, quote unquote, of developing that argument in Poe versus Ullman in an interesting article published in The Nation in the 70s sometime, actually. Anybody wants a copy? Well, you can Google it and get it.
Well, Mel Wolf. Okay.
Anything else I can tell you? Can I tell you about why the only corporations I ever represented in my legal career were publishing companies, which were a special exception to my rule that I don't do corporate law?
Well, that's great. You know, one of my heroes is Edmund Wilson, the finest literary critic, I think. And Edmund Wilson's father was a lawyer in New Jersey.
Yes.
And he refused to represent corporations. When his friend Woodrow Wilson became president, the family had every expectation that Mr. Wilson would go to the Supreme Court. That never happened. But it didn't hurt him to not represent corporations.
No, Edmund Wilson is a towering figure.
Well, Mel Wolf, thank you very much. And hopefully in a few years, we'll be able to get Ed Snowden's passport back, reverse the AG decision, and maybe have a different country.
Perhaps. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mel Wolf, you're truly a lawyer you'll like, and we appreciate having you on the show.
Very likable.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Attorney Bill Schaap, who died in 2016, was a friend and colleague of Mel Wolf's. Bill and his wife, Ellen Ray, published the historic whistleblowing magazine Covert Action, which exposed the illegalities of the CIA. Then they started Sheridan Square Press. They published a number of memoirs of former CIA agents who revealed the truth about the activities of the CIA. Ex-CIA agent Phil Agee was one of Sheridan Square Press's authors. He wrote Inside the Company, which exposed the names of some 200 CIA agents involved in nefarious activities in South America. Mel Wolf represented Agee for 30 years and, unsuccessfully, tried to get his passport back when the government had it taken away. We rebroadcast today an interview that Michael Ratner and I did with our friend and colleague Bill Schaap. It is part of the Lawyers You'll Like programs we've done on Law and Disorder. Covert Action has been started up again by Phil Agee's son, Chris Agee, and is available online.
Attorney Bill Schaap graduated from law school at the University of Chicago in 1964 and has been practicing law ever since. Bill specialized in military law initially, practicing in both Okinawa and then in Germany. He later became the editor-in-chief of the Military Law Reporter in Washington for a number of years. In the 70s and 80s, he was staff counsel at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. In the late 80s, he was an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, where he taught courses on propaganda and disinformation. In addition to being a practicing lawyer, Bill was a journalist, publisher,
and a writer specializing in intelligence as it relates to the media. He was the co-publisher of the great magazine Covert Action Quarterly for more than 20 years. He also published a magazine on propaganda and disinformation called Lies of Our Times. Bill Schaap has written many articles and edited a number of books on the topic of media and intelligence. He joins us today on Lawyers You'll Like to discuss his work as a lawyer and a writer. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Bill, how does a high school guy from Freeport, Long Island, who goes to the University of Chicago and gets a job at a Wall Street firm, how does he end up doing movement political work? What was it that got you started on the that road?
Well, it was fairly quick and fairly direct. One of the first big cases I worked on at this Wall Street firm, they had some outside counsel working on it, one of whom was Dave Lubell. And Dave Lubell, who had, I think, been a recruiter for the Communist Party in his youth, was always good at spotting somebody who might be worth recruiting. And he started to tell me that there was a convention of this lawyers group coming up. And I said, I really don't like lawyers groups. And he said, you'll like this one. And it was the 1967 Lawyers Guild Convention in New York. He dragged me to one event, and I met Bill Kunstler, I met Arthur Kanoy, and I met Victor Rabinowitz and all the old-timers. And I'd been on Wall Street for a year or two. I said, I didn't even know there were lawyers like this. So I joined the same day, met Bernadine Dorn, and a few weeks later, she called me and said, we need your help. And I said, what do you need my help for? She said, you got to defend a bunch of Columbia students. And I said, what'd they do? She said, well, they're protesting a gymnasium. They're trying to tear down the fence. I said, What's wrong with the gymnasium? She said, you don't understand. I'll explain it to you. So, of course, Columbia was taking over half of Morningside Park, trying to turn it into a Columbia student gymnasium, not a people's gymnasium. The next thing I knew, the whole riot started at Columbia. And she said, as soon as they start arresting people, you're going to have to go down and defend them. And I said, I've never done that. And she said, it'll be very easy. And shortly before the arrests happened, I went to the December 10th dinner, I guess it was ECLC.
That's the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee.
So I was sitting at a
table.
And
they were set up in part because the ACLU would not defend the Communist Party.
That's
and
right.
Dissidents in the Communist
Leonard
Party.
Leonard Boudin was their chief counsel.
Yeah. So I went, this was my first legal political thing I went to, and I was sitting at a table with Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoy and Victor Rabinowitz and a few other people like that. And somebody comes rushing in and says, we just got a phone call. A bunch of people got busted at a demonstration protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. He was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, and he was thinking of running for president.
And he supported the war against the Vietnamese.
He was everything bad about the word liberal is what he was. He was a liberal warmonger. So in any event, they went around the table, and all of a sudden I noticed everybody's looking at me because Kunstler, it was 11 o'clock at night. Kunstler didn't want to run down to night court, and Kanoy didn't want to run down to night court, and I'm like the youngest one at the table, and I've been practicing law for a couple of years. And they said, go on, do it. And I said, I don't even know what an arraignment is. And Kunstler said, it's easy. Let me tell you, go down there. The first thing you do is make friends with the clerk, because if you're ever doing criminal law, make friends with the clerk, go in the back, fill out all the little notices in advance, sign your name on 50 pieces of paper, and give them to him. So I go there. All these people got arrested protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. And I'm looking at the list, and one of the people on this list of like 30 or 40 defendants was Paul Krasner, who was sort of a friend I knew from before. I said, oh, boy, because I looked into the audience, and there were like 200 people there, and it's midnight. And I said, what the 200? How many? And they were almost all of them were Krasner's friends. The word had gotten out that he'd been busted. He was in jail. And
Krasner at the time was the editor of the great magazine, The Realist.
The Realist,
which was a political satire magazine.
Very, very well known and very clever, smart guy. So I said, I hope he doesn't come to way near the end. I've never done this before. And then they call the first case, and it's Krasner. And he comes up there, and everybody in the audience jumps up and starts screaming and yelling and cheering. And the judge says, clear the courtroom, clear the courtroom. Get rid of them all. Get them all out of here. And there were about seven or eight elderly black women in the back row who were there for their sons or husbands or whatever, who were just ordinary criminal cases. And they said, not us, Your Honor. We don't know this guy. We don't have anything to do with him. And he said, all right, the old ladies in the back row can stay. Everybody else get out of the courtroom. And so they call the first case, and it's Paul, and he's standing next to me. And he said, I'm going to get life. And I said, no, it's disorderly conduct. I don't think you're going to get life. And I said, what happened? He said, well, they told me I could have not been arrested if I said I was there as a journalist, but I, out of solidarity, I refused to do that. So I came up with everybody. He said, but I had a big problem with the arresting officer who's really wants to throw the book at me. I said, why is that? He said, well, they have this new thing now. Since at mass arrests, one officer would be assigned like 30 or 40 people, and he'd never remember who was who. And when you'd go in for a first court appearance, you'd keep your client back sitting with like five other people and say, all right, officer so-and-so, which one of them is the guy you arrested? And he would have no idea. So they started taking Polaroid pictures of the arresting officer standing next to the defendant, so he'd have them with him in his pocket to look and make sure he knew. And Paul said, so when they put us together for the Polaroid picture, I turned to the guy and said, where are we going after the prom, sweetie? And he said, and the guy went ballistic. So
we're talking to Bill Schaap, Lawyers You'll Like. Bill is talking about his beginnings as a movement lawyer in the 60s. We just talked about Paul Krasner, political satirist
that Bill was defending in court.
Okay, so Bill, eventually you ended up going to Okinawa defending soldiers in the anti-war movement, and then also, I think, in Germany. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was, I was hanging out at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I was there one afternoon, and we had just decided that morning that Lubell, Fine & Schaap was going to fold.
That was a law firm you went to after Wall Street.
Right, and we discovered that having no paying clients would lead to bankruptcy. Sure as... So I said, what am I going to do? And I hear a voice from over a cubicle, and it was Greg Finger. He said, you want to go to Okinawa?
Greg Finger was, I think at that time, administrative director right. of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I said, well, I'm open for anything. I said, this for me and Ellen? She said, yeah, we got jobs for both of you. And the next thing I know, a few days later, I was signed up to be a staff counsel on the Lawyers Guild project, military law project in Okinawa.
And Ellen Ray, of course, is your companion, and you and Ellen,
she was
head out to the east.
She was quickly nicknamed Della Street by the military judges. And we spent the next 3 years, 4 years, doing military law all over the world. That was what got us really interested in international stuff. When we first went over there, we didn't even know what the CIA was, and most people in America didn't know what the CIA was. We're talking like 71, 72. This is long before the Church Committee reports, or several years. And when you work overseas in that kind of a climate with the military, and you learn a lot fast about American imperialism, and then once you learn that, you learn about the CIA. And that led us to, when we finally got back, deciding to work on originally on Counter Spy magazine and then on Covert Action magazine.
I was a subscriber to Covert Action Quarterly, as was Michael Ratner, a great magazine. What was the purpose of the magazine? Because now you're wearing a journalist editor hat. And what did you try to accomplish with the magazine?
Let's just note that Bill was co-publisher of Covert Action for nearly 20 years.
Yeah. We started it on a shoestring, and the original purpose was just to expose the CIA. We worked with Lou Wolf, who was an expert at uncovering CIA agents in U.S. embassies, not through any classified documents, but because if you knew how to read the paperwork and State Department things, you could tell who were the ringers, and you knew these people were CIA. And we were so successful that Congress passed a law against us.
Let's stay up. Let's go too fast, because the magazine, it was a really famous and well-known magazine, and there's still people who look at it as this is the highest level of American journalism, what this magazine was doing. And there was a number of years when there were actually incredible lists of CIA people who were disrupting the politics of other countries that you guys published. So talk about that for a minute as to what your goal was, and then the struggle over when they tried to outlaw you.
Yeah, our goal really was to try and make these people ineffective, because the only way most CIA case officers could work, particularly the ones that were assigned to an embassy, was to have to pretend to be something else. They were all, you know, third assistant political secretaries, second assistant, whatever, and those were all phony things. And their job was to inveigle their way into various community organizations in whatever foreign capital they might have been posted, to recruit people to turn against their own countries, be traitors to their own countries, and become spies for the U.S. So we thought that if we identify these people beforehand, it might make their job a little harder, which it did. Of course, the problem was the government said we were trying to get them killed, which we weren't trying to do, and nobody we exposed ever did get killed. But they were very fortunate that one CIA station chief in Athens named Richard Welch was exposed by a Greek group and assassinated. And for a long time, everybody, including President Gerald Ford, tried to say that he got assassinated because we exposed him. And in fact, we hadn't. We later, with the help of Mort Halperin, who had connections to the State Department, discovered cables where Welch had been warned not to move into his predecessor's house in Athens because everybody in Athens knew that was where the CIA chief of station lived. And we found a cable he sent back, said, "I'm sorry, my wife really likes the house. We're going to move in." And they moved in, and like 3 days later, he was gunned down on the front steps.
Now, they tried to pin that on you guys for a long time.
They did. Well, Gerald Ford said it directly.
It's still, when you read stuff, it's still like one of the incidents they point to. There's someone you haven't mentioned yet. I'm interested in what his role was. And Phil Agee is dead now, but he published a book called Inside the Company, which exposed the names of hundreds of agents subverting democracy and unionization in Latin America and Central America. Now, he had some relationship to the magazine, or?
No, we founded it with him. He had been an advisor to Counterspy. Counterspy folded when Welch got killed because of the pressure was too much, and we started the new one called Covert Action, and we worked with Phil directly the whole time. He was not the person who was discovering who the undercover people were. Lew Wolf was doing that. But Phil wrote articles for us in every issue, and we worked very closely with him. And in fact, some of us traveled around the world when he was asked to go to various places to try to expose CIA operations, the most well-known being Jamaica, when the CIA was trying to overthrow the government of Michael Manley. And the government asked Phil Agee to come down and help, and Phil asked Ellen Ray to come down and help him help them. And once you start exposing these things, they really don't have any defense.
Were you harassed yourself, and was Covert Action infiltrated or attempts to close the paper down, the magazine down?
So far as we know, we weren't infiltrated because it was just the three of us. We didn't have a big – we did everything. I mean, we waxed the galleys. We rolled them down with them. We did everything. So they couldn't actually infiltrate the organization, but they certainly did try to catch us in something phony. We would get tips that turned out to be CIA trying to get us to print some story that wasn't true so they could then discredit us. No, we actually had more direct interference from the government when we were doing the military law work before Covert Action. The military is always a bit more heavy-handed than the CIA, and they would plant bugs in our attic and in Okinawa and things like that. But they didn't know we were very close to a lot of MPs, and they used to bring us the transcripts and show us that they were recording everything that was going on at the legal counseling. And I ended up getting 100 court-martial convictions thrown out because they were eavesdropping the defense attorney. And if you prove the defense attorney was being eavesdropped, you won the case.
One more question on the magazine, Bill. There was a point where after you'd published the names of CIA agents for many years, that they passed a law. It was really, you would have to call it the Covert Action Information Bulletin Law, because it was passed to stop your work, which was all taken from public sources. So tell us what that law is and what's been its sort of history as we've gone forward.
It's only been used a few times. It was... it's called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, and there are two parts. One makes it a crime for someone who is in the government, has classified information, to reveal someone's identity. But the second part makes it a crime to reveal the identity of someone that you did not learn from classified information or from your position, but if, and this was the tricky, they put in word, but if you were in the business of exposing these kind of people. And we actually, at one point, Floyd Abrams had gone down to Washington on behalf of AP, CBS, and the New York Times to protest the law. And then he came back and he said, nobody has to worry. They're only interested in getting Covert Action magazine.
Bill, you published a book long before I ever met you, a book that I bought and read and cherished about Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, who investigated the Kennedy assassination. Tell us what was behind that, because it was quite an extraordinary thing when you published that book.
Yeah, it was mostly due to the fact that Ellen Ray had known Jim back when he was investigating Clay Shaw, and she had actually gone down to New Orleans in 67 and 68 and been one of his clack of supporters. But then we got a call from Mary Howell, the guild lawyer in New Orleans. She was a friend of Jim Garrison's, and she said he had a manuscript, and he had a publisher, but the publisher had rejected it. They thought it was a little too outré. And we went down to meet with him, and Ellen said, oh, Jim Garrison, my idol. I'd love. And the problem was that he had written the book in the third person, and it was obvious that the book should be written in the first person. So we had to go out. We hired Zach Sklar, who was a great editor at the time, and we redid the book, and it became JFK, and it was a bestseller. And we were in Havana. He doesn't admit this, Oliver Stone, but we met him in Havana.
Yeah, I heard that during Ellen cornered him in an elevator.
Right, during the film festival, and she said, have I got a property for you? Because we knew he was an assassination freak, and we gave him an advance copy of the book. And like that same night, he called and said, it's really very interesting. I can't do anything with it, but it's really very interesting. And the next day, he called and said, listen, it's really very interesting. Don't sell it to anybody else. And then the third day, he called and said, I want to buy it, but you have to keep it top secret until I do the film, and we did, and he made a hell of a film.
Well, Zach Sklar wrote the screenplay with Oliver.
Right.
It was a hell of a film. It's coming out again, you know, at the 50th anniversary.
Right, I think they're
doing
a director's
cut. Assassination. In a nutshell, what would you say the message of that film was?
Well, I think there may be a couple of little things that are off, but basically I think Garrison had the scenario down better than any of the other writers about the Kennedy assassination. And he had down about the involvement of the Cuban exiles, the involvement of the CIA, the involvement of some military people. It's not something you can explain in 1 minute, but everybody that's been written about it agrees that Oswald was a patsy, just like he said, and that it was rogue elements of the government and the CIA that were involved. There are Cuban exiles all over the place. Now, I mean, New Orleans and Dallas and the whole Gulf Coast was filled with Cuban exiles in those days.
You published a newsletter called Lies of Our Times, and it was aimed at the newspaper that prints everything that's fit, the New York Times. But more generally, it was devised to expose government disinformation and propaganda. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, that was in the 80s or 90s, Bill?
It was in the 90s, from 1990 to 1995, I think. We did 6 years of it. It was, to a certain extent, the abuses we were crying about got a little bit less over time, because that sometimes is the helpful result of this kind of exposure. But we were just tired with people thinking that if it was in the New York Times, it must be true, or if Dan Rather said it, it must be true, or whatever. And the fact is, those people lie all the time. If it suits their people's needs. So we had a great run. We had Noam Chomsky did a regular column every issue for us, and we had a lot of really good writers from all over the world, mostly from the States, explaining how stories that had become gospel were really completely untrue.
Bill, you've taught courses on propaganda and disinformation at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and you've been in the field for decades. How do you comment on the American people's response to recent revelations of the ubiquitous surveillance state and really a secret government? Have things changed for the better or the worse in terms of public awareness and response?
I think they've changed a bit for the better. We're still way behind Europe, where the average European is skeptical of anything its government says, and that's not so much the case here. But I think we've gotten to a point where people recognize that the government lies to them. They recognize that there's an awful lot that goes on that they don't know very much about. it's a big step up from in the 60s and 70s. Most Americans had no idea what was good. They didn't know what the NSA was. The NSA was secret. They barely knew what the CIA was. And they had no idea that all that stuff was going on. Nor did they have any notion of the degree to which the government had influence in the media, particularly the foreign media. I mean, that was one of the CIA's best operations, was to control journalists all over the world, including American journalists. But sometimes you didn't even have to, because you could plant a story with an agent in Germany, and then Reuters would pick it up, and then AP would pick it up, and then the story that the CIA guy wrote would be in the front page of the American papers without anybody publishing it being aware of that.
Bill, you started the Institute for Media Analysis to try to give a boost to people that were doing the kind of thing that you and Ellen had been doing all those years. Tell us about that.
Well, we set up, we actually got nonprofit tax-exempt status fairly quickly, which was a little bit surprising. Mel Wolf was representing us at the time. I didn't want to represent myself. And originally, the government tried to deny the application, and they sent him a letter saying, what political party does Ed Herman belong to? What political party does Bill Shapp and Ellen Ray belong to? And he sent them back this scathing thing as the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, blah, 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 blah. And they just backed off and immediately granted it. Now, it's funny because there's all this talk going on now about the Obama administration and the IRS vamping on the Tea Party organizations that want to get tax exemption. Well, in the Reagan years, and the IRS was vamping on the left-wing groups exactly the same. I mean, it's the notion that the IRS is completely divorced from the administration power is nonsense. People, I mean, there may be a few Korea people, but a lot of people come in each time there's a new administration who think the way that administration thinks. But anyway, Mel's letter did the trick, and we got the tax exemption. And then we started, we were publishing pamphlets in the beginning that people were writing for us. Some by Phil Agee. We did one by Edgar Chamorro about the role of the CIA and the Contras in Nicaragua. One by Carl Ginsburg about the Moynihan Report and racism. And then we started the magazine and The Lies of Our Times, and we started doing books. We actually published half a dozen books, although book publishing is much harder than magazine publishing. It's a much bigger investment, and since we were, by definition, not publishing things that we expected to be bestsellers, it was a little risky to begin with.
There were a couple of books I remember. They were great. One was, and I think the first one you did, was called White Paper, White Wash.
Right.
And it was by Phil Agee. And at that time, the U.S. government had issued a series of documents trying to show, was it Cuban or Russian support for the El Salvador insurgents, the revolutionaries. And Phil just... What did he do?
Well, he just he went through it, and he showed how every one of these things were a lie, and some of the documents were forgeries. The whole white paper was a scam. One of the greatest things about even the naming names columns and stuff is that we were doing this stuff and we didn't get killed. And that was a very helpful example for other people, because people constantly would ask us, how come you haven't been assassinated?
The column is called Naming Names.
Right. And Phil would say, I don't think they want to make martyrs out of us. Because people always ask Phil Agee why the CIA hadn't assassinated him. And
he couldn't live here, though. He had to go live in Cuba.
Well, for a long time. But we also discovered when Mel was doing Freedom of Information.
That's Mel Wolf, who's a former legal director for the ACLU.
Yeah, he did Phil's Freedom of Information Acts, and we discovered documents that at least showed that there was a big CIA Justice Department meeting about assassinating him. And it was then sort of covered up, and it came out stuck in a bunch of FOIA stuff. And we went to the judge in the case to try and get more, because these were obviously got in there by accident. The judge said, I'm going to look at this stuff in camera. And after he looked at it in camera, he said, well, I've looked at it, and you ain't going to get it.
when we think about that, and it would surprise me if they hadn't at least had that kind of meeting about Ed Snowden, whether he should be killed. I think they probably came out, he shouldn't be, for maybe political reasons, but also because there may be stuff that he's given to other people all over the world and that they don't have access to.
I wanted to ask Bill what advice you would have for young attorneys considering a progressive practice who may be frightened by government tactics.
The fact of the matter is that you, as we know from Lawyers Guild people all over the country, you can be a politically active, politically conscious lawyer and still make a living. You know, you're not going to be like a Wall Street tycoon, but there are a large chunk of the American people who are progressive, and most of them, when they have legal stuff, they'd rather have a progressive lawyer. It doesn't mean you have to defend them against some, you know, big criminal case. I mean, progressive people want a progressive lawyer to do their will or buy their house or do their whatever. And I don't necessarily encourage progressives to become lawyers, but I do encourage lawyers to become progressives.
On that note, Bill, it's been an astounding career. I mean, it really taking on the state, imperialism, the CIA, and one that had plenty of risks with it. So thank you from all of us.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on Law & Disorder. You are truly a lawyer you'll like.
Thanks.
Bill Schaap and his companion Ellen Ray, along with Lou Wolf and Phil Agee, with the help of our own Michael Ratner, launched Covert Action magazine years ago to expose the crimes of the CIA. And we're happy to know that Covert Action magazine is back in business. You can get a hold of it on the internet. Covert Action.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.